Let's begin with our lecture verse. The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So it's good to see you all here this morning on a bright, cold May morning. It's hard to believe we had snow yesterday, but that's what they call alpine weather. So that's what we've got. I want to talk this morning as part of a series I've been doing, I've been calling Attitude of Gratitude. And this is part six. Okay, I started this over a year ago, and so I just didn't have an opportunity to do a Sunday talk. I just continue. I've been using as an outline the first three vows of Samantabhadra Bodhisattva, and in particular looking at the teachings of Great Master Dogen in the Shobo Genzo, and see how he expresses these. There's 10 vows of Samantabhadra Bodhisattva, and they're found in the Avatamsaka scripture. That's the flower ornament scripture. That's one of our great Mahayana scriptures from Northern Buddhism. The Avatam scripture is all about the training of a bodhisattva, you know, a being whose heart is set upon the enlightenment of all beings, not just oneself, but all beings. The scripture climaxes with the vows of Samantabhadra, which are like a crystallization of the whole scripture. The last chapter, which is a whole volume in itself, is about the lay pilgrim Sudana, who's traveling and asking questions of all these different teachers. You know, like there's like 53 different teachers, and they're from all walks of life. There's monks, there's lay people, there's women, women, there's goddesses, you know, there's ordinary workers. And so he's learning from all these different people. And as he approaches the end, as he's approaching Maitreya Buddha, who is the Buddha that is to come, that's who, you know, he's becoming. He's becoming that Buddha. He's given the vows of Samantabhadra as, you know, an explanation of what he's been doing all this time. And there's, as I said, there's 10 of them. And the first one, as I've talked about, is to bow to all Buddhas. And that's one of the reasons why in the monastery, when you pass in front of a Buddha statue, you make a bow. But it's not limited to just statues. It's any time you approach anyone, you know, you bow to their Buddha nature, you know. And this is, you know, in the monastery we have, you know, the luxury really of being able to do that in a formal sense. But you can do that in daily life, just in your own mind. You know, when you meet someone, just recognize their Buddha nature and treat them as Buddha. The second vow is to praise Tathagata, which is another word for Buddha. And I've talked about how that's an expression of scriptures, and how we're actually all always giving voice to the Dharma in our everyday life. What we say can be taken as teaching by other people. Reverend Master Daizui, who was the head of our order after Reverend Master Jiu, used to say, you can't help but teach. You know, your life is an expression of the Dharma. Okay? The third vow is to make abundant offerings. And Reverend Master Jiu expressed this as proffering abundant oblations. Now, why did she use kind of this flowery language to express this? I think she did it in order to really give a dignity to the vows of Samantabhadra. Bodhisattvas usually are dressed in the clothing of Indian royalty, okay? The vows are often called the 10 kingly vows or lordly vows. I haven't found a good gender-neutral adjective for that yet. I usually just say the great vows. But living the life of a bodhisattva is a noble thing to do. And it's like when we, come to the temple, we wear some of our nicest clothing. We don't wear just, dirty jeans and a t-shirt, or when you're at the monastery, if we're doing outside work, we change into our work clothes. But then, when we come to meditation, we change back in for monks. We wear our robes. If you're a layperson, you put on, some clean clothing. It's to remind us that there is a aspect of purifying our heart when we come to practice, okay? It's to remind us that what we do with our body and, our external appearance is an expression of what we're doing with our mind, okay? So I'm gonna move toward talking about Dogen, but I'm gonna start with the actual vows as they're expressed in the Avatamsaka scripture. And so this is, being given to Sudana. And the teaching is, moreover, good person, to extensively cultivate making offerings is explained like this. And then there's an description of, in every mote of dust in all the Buddha lands, throughout the 10 directions, and the 3 periods of time, exhausting the realm of empty space, there are Buddhas, as many as the fine motes of dust in all the worlds. Okay. Avatamsaka scripture works, and many of our Mahayana scriptures, is that it is trying to expand our minds. Okay, it's often talking in terms of infinity or boundless, and it's in order to stretch our minds. In Chinese Buddhism, they use koans to kind of push us beyond our conceptual minds. This is what the scripture Great Wisdom describes as the wisdom that is beyond discriminative thought. Okay, it's to push us beyond the opposites. In Indian scriptures, the way they do that is continuing to get us to try to think in terms of infinity or boundlessness, you know. You can't do that with the rational mind. You know, it pushes us beyond our ordinary discriminatory thinking. Okay? So Sudana says in expressing this vow, to each Buddha, and you know, again, we're talking about, you know, billions of Buddhas, to each Buddha, I make offerings of superb and wonderful gifts, such as clouds of flowers, clouds of garlands, clouds of heavenly music, clouds of divine canopies. And this is why we have this light here, which we call the heavenly canopy, okay? Clouds of heavenly clothing, varieties of heavenly incense, fragrant balms, powdered incense, granular incense, and clouds of other such gifts. Each cloud is as large as Sumeru, the king of mountains. That's the Buddha's cosmic mountain, and our big altar up here in the Buddha Hall is called the Mount Sumeru altar, and the way it's constructed is that there's three steps going up, and then you have to take the leap of faith because there's a cliff, and then there's an overhang, so you have to even, you know, go beyond that to get to the top, okay? So we're talking about something that is, you know, unimaginably large or tall or high, okay? The scripture continues, I burn all kinds of lamps, butter lamps, oil lamps, and lamps of many fragrant oils. The wick of each lamp is as tall as Mount Sumeru. The quantity of oil in each lamp is equal in volume to the waters of the great sea. With all manner of gifts such as these, I constantly make offerings. Now, you know, realistically, we can't do that. Okay, but we can make the wish to do that in our minds. And this is part of the value of having a home altar, is there's a focus for that wish. When you offer incense, you can make the wish, I wish to make this offering with the spirit of incense as high as Mount Sumeru. Or when you light a candle, you can make the wish that, you know, it shine as bright as the sun or as many as the stars in the sky. You know, when you place a water offering on the altar, you can make the wish that, you know, may this offering be as vast as the ocean. When you put fruit or food on the altar, you can make the wish, may this be as vast enough to feed all the hungry people of the world. Okay, this is to help us develop a generous heart. You know, if we could, we would do this. That's how great our wish is, and that ties it directly with the Bodhisattva vow of wanting to save all beings, you know, throughout endless time. You know, that's how large we want our heart to be. Okay. So we wish to make these material offerings, but we don't stop there. Okay. There's also the offering of our practice. There's the offering of our training. The scripture goes on. Good person, of all offerings, the gift of Dharma is supreme. That includes offerings such as the offering of cultivating according to the teachings, the offering of benefiting all living beings, the offering of gathering in all living beings, the offering of diligently cultivating good roots, the offering of not forsaking the deeds of a bodhisattva, and the offering of not renouncing the bodhi mind, or the bodhicitta, the Buddha heart, this a wish to benefit and help all beings. This offering of our practice, this offering of the Dharma, is the offering of wisdom. Okay, we want to give, but we want to give with wisdom. We want to make our gift one of wise discernment. Okay, this wise discernment is prajna. Again, this is what the scripture Great Wisdom is referring to. The wisdom that is beyond discriminative thought. And if you study the Great Wisdom scriptures, it makes the point that all of the bodhisattva practices, the paramitas, need to be done with wisdom. And it's actually wisdom is what makes them a paramita. And paramita is a Buddhist word that means crossing over to the other shore. Okay, and as the scripture Great Wisdom says, the prajna paramita, the wisdom paramita, is the greatest mantra of them all. Okay, so we give with prajna, with wisdom. I've seen in Tibetan Buddhism, sometimes they translate it as wisdom realizing emptiness. Okay, wisdom leading to the realization of the purity of all things, the Buddha nature of all things. Emptiness is a translation of shunyata, okay, which in scripture, Great Wisdom, Brother Master Jiyu translated as pure, the pure of all things. Okay, using pure as a noun, even though we usually think of it as an adjective, you know, but it's something that's pure beyond the opposites of pure and impure. Okay, again, it's pointing us to something, you know, beyond. Okay, I want to do a little detour here and read you a little something from the teachings of Ajahn Chah, who's the great Thai meditation master. And this is from a book called Stillness Flowing, Life and Teachings of Ajahn Chah. And this book itself is a really good example of how this giving or generosity works. Now, this book was, the publication of it was underwritten by lay Buddhists in Thailand, Malaysia, and Singapore. Okay. It was transported over the Pacific Ocean. It came to Abhayagiri Monastery, which is a Theravadan monastery down on the central coast of California. They gave the book to the monks here, you know, and I in turn am offering you teachings from that book. So you can see how that initial offering had a knock-on effect. It had ripples, you know, that continue, okay? And now hopefully I've offered you something from the book that you can take into your life and pass on. Okay? So this is from the chapter on lay practice. And he's talking about merit, you know. Merit is, you know, good energy, okay? It's what results as a... That's okay. It's what results as a, from our practice, okay? And... it says making merit, you know, is the most popular religious practice of Thai lay Buddhists. Okay, and often in Asia, in some Buddhist traditions, it's thought that's the only practice that lay people can do. It's a distortion of the teaching, but it's, you know, sometimes misunderstandings begin and then just kind of grow or continue. And Ajahn Chah is trying to make the point that I just made in regards to the Avatamsaka scripture, is that, yes, make material offerings, but also make an offering of your practice. Do your meditation and often offer the merit of that. Do your offerings with wisdom. Okay? I'm just quoting here. Ajahn Chah warned that all merit-making acts, beginning with generosity, needed to be performed with awareness. Okay. Generosity is, we sometimes call it dana. Okay. It's giving. And it's the first practice that's taught in all Buddhist traditions because it's a way of letting go of the self. We have to give up something in order to give it to others. Okay. Ajahn Chah said that a love of making merit, unaccompanied by the determination to abandon harmful actions of body, speech, and mind, demonstrates a lack of understanding of what merit really is. And then Ajahn Chah explained that kusala is a Buddhist word meaning good merit, okay, or skillful merit, or wholesome merit, kusala. Okay. Kusala was a wisdom factor that was needed to govern the performance of meritorious acts. Without this kind of wisdom, people could become overly concerned with the anticipated future rewards of their good actions, or be influenced by desire for praise or good name in their community. Many would simply bask in the good feelings produced by their good actions and see no need to penetrate any further into the Buddha's teachings. And this is quoting Ajahn Chah directly. Make merit in order to gradually reduce the suffering in your mind. to do that, you must, at the same time, develop wholesome qualities in your mind. Merit by itself is just like fresh meat or fish. Ajahn Chah was famous for his graphic examples. Okay. If you leave it around too long, it will go rotten. Okay. If you want to keep it for a long time, you have to salt it or put it in the fridge. As you make merit, you know, as you make these offerings, keep reflecting. By that I mean using your intelligence or wisdom to destroy defilements. Why? Keep up your meditation. Give with wisdom. Give with wise discernment. Okay? Now, let's look at how Dogen expresses this. Great Master Dogen, I think as most of you know, is the founder of our tradition in Japan. And he wrote this masterwork of 100 chapters, and this is just half of it. Okay, and he has an entire chapter. This is chapter 86 in Reverend Master Hubert's translation, and it's called On Making Venerative Offerings to Buddhas. And I really encourage you to read this for yourself. It's not obscure like many of Dogen's writings are. It's very straightforward. It said, well, what we have actually is a rough draft of what Dogen wrote. We don't have the finished product. He didn't finish it. And, you know, there's some people that say, well, he probably would have edited a bit more carefully. And maybe so. But I find it interesting because you can see Dogen at work. You know, he's got all of his scripture books out in front of him, and he's copying out passages from all these different scriptures and then writing a little comments. And he covers a whole vast range of scriptures, from the Lotus Scripture, the Parinirvana Scripture, Nagarjuna's commentary on the heart scripture, you know, the monastic regulations. And so he's quoting from all these different scriptures. He talks about stupas and how to construct a stupa, how to worship relics. As Reverend Master Hubert says in the introduction, in all of these, you know, what is important is the attitude of mind behind the offering. And when it is free of any tinge of self, the merit that returns to the giver thereby is beyond measure. Okay? I'm just going to give you one example from this chapter, you know, and then in a subsequent talk, I'll talk about some of the others. That'll be part 7, okay? Although it's quite a long chapter. But in each of them, Dogen is making the same point. So this is quoting the Buddha from a scripture I've never heard of before, but Dogen, you know, is pulling out a lot of obscure scriptures to make his point. Their monastery was given a set of the whole scriptures at some point by his lay patron. And so Dogen, you know, we know there's a specific date in which that gift was given, and we see a shift in his writings where he's, you know, you can almost kind of literally see him reading and pulling out, you know, all these different scriptures. Okay? So this is one that's called The Scriptural Collection, The Past Deeds of the Buddha. And it says, the Buddha once told Moggallana, and that was one of the Buddha's chief disciples, I recall from my past having planted good roots in places where there were immeasurable, unbounded, world-honored ones, and having ultimately sought supreme, fully perfected enlightenment. O Moggallana, I recall from my past having taken on the body of a saintly, wheel-turning lord. This is like a universal emperor. Okay. And having encountered 30 billion Buddhas, yeah, all sharing the same name as myself. Out of esteem for them, along with my assembly of disciples, we sustain them by respectfully making offerings to them the four necessities, namely shelter, clothing, food, and medicine. However, at that time, those Buddhas did not foretell my future by saying, you will realize fully perfected enlightenment and become one who understands the ways of the world. Okay? The Buddha is said, I did all this, but it didn't lead to my enlightenment. And then the Buddha says, I recall another past life where taking on the body of a universal emperor. I made all these offerings, you know, the four necessities, along with banners and canopies, flowers and incense. But the Buddha didn't foretell my future enlightenment. Right? And then Dogen kind of goes on for a number of pages, quoting from these different scriptures. And you see the same thing happening in each one of these descriptions of the Buddha describing his past acts, but none of them, you know, leading to full enlightenment. And the Buddha says, it's kind of a little refrain that goes through all of them. None of these past Buddhas foretold my future as a future Buddha because of my giving alms had an ulterior motive. Otherwise, I was trying to get something. Okay, I posited a self here that wanted to get something. Dogen is quite famous for warning his monks and lay disciples about the danger of fame and gain. Okay, we can also think, well, I'm not seeking to be famous. I'm not seeking to be wealthy. But it can go a lot subtler than that. You know, are we seeking to be well thought of in the community? Are we seeking praise from our fellow trainees? Are we trying to gain merit? You know, the problem is the wanting something, okay? Which of course leads back to the Buddha saying that our wanting, our desire, this is the cause of our suffering, okay? You know, that we're wanting something that we already have, but we think we don't. So we externalize that want and try to fulfill that desire with other stuff instead of being content within our own Buddha nature and knowing that we already have everything that we need. And then because we have everything that we already need, we can be generous. Okay? This is the same point that Bodhidharma, you know, the first Zen ancestor in China, you know, was trying to make to the emperor of China when he went to China and had an interview with the emperor, and the emperor was saying, you know, I've built all these Buddhist temples, I've organized the ordination of all these monks, you know, I've done all this stuff. How much merit have I gained? And Bodhidharma says, none. You know, the emperor wasn't happy with that answer, so Bodhidharma, in the middle of the night, had to cross the river into the neighboring kingdom. You know, he was probably incurring the wrath of the emperor for having told the emperor to his face, "No, you haven't got it. You know, no, you missed the boat here." Okay. So Dogen's quoting Shakyamuni. You know, all these different instances where he made all these offerings, but no one foretold him becoming a Buddha because there was an ulterior motive. Okay. But the good news is the Buddha finally got it. Okay. The Buddha says, "I tossed about like this." And it's just pages and pages and billions of lives, you know. Until I met Dipankara, the Buddha whose radiance is constant, whereupon I was immediately able to realize the non-arising of all thoughts and things. Otherwise, he started to meditate and see that things are empty of a self. There's no arising of thoughts and things. Everything is pure. It's already there. You know, there's no arising. There's no passing away. Again, Scripture's great wisdom. Increasing not, decreasing not. And it was at that time that this Buddha foretold my future Buddhahood, saying, "In the future, you will be able to realize Buddhahood." Otherwise, the Buddha will say, "Now you got it." Okay, just continue in this direction, and it will lead to your full enlightenment. Now you've got it. Okay. And Dogen says, from his, Shakyamuni's, initial encounter with 30 billion Buddhas up to his meeting the Tathagata Dipankara, he constantly served as a saintly wheel-turning lord, spending his whole life offering them alms. He made offerings of all manner of pleasant things during each lifetime of some 80 or 90,000 years. In these scriptures, the Buddha to be encountered 30 billion Shakyamuni Buddhas. But his training didn't fully ripen until he let go of his ulterior motive, until he let go of the idea of a self that had to get something. Okay. So what Dogen is pointing out is, yes, make offerings. There's merit in making offerings. But do you practice? Make an an offering of your practice. Make an offering of your meditation. You know, give with wise discernment. Do your meditation purify your mind and your heart? Okay, because that's what leads to true peace of mind and heart. Offerings are wonderful. Please make them. But do your practice. Okay? And, you know, I think one of the points that comes through in this also is that you can see that the Buddha himself, he got stuck in a rut. Okay? Billions and billions of lives. He was just making all these offerings and not really getting anywhere. And sometimes in our training, it can feel that way, like we're stuck in a rut. You know, and we just keep doing the practice. Nothing seems to be happening. Okay, but we don't give up. We keep doing the practice. We keep making offerings. We keep endeavoring to train. And eventually, the penny drops, the light bulb comes on, and we get it, okay? And Reverend Master Jiu once asked D.T. Suzuki, who she studied with. He was a famous Buddhist scholar, particularly in Rinzai Zen, who was very influential in introducing Buddhism to the West. She asked him, you know, have you ever had a kensho, you know, a spiritual awakening? And he said, no, once or twice, but a thousand times the million, a thousand times the many little moments that make me dance. Okay? Reverend Master Jiu, in quoting that in the Kyoju Kaimon commentary, said a million times the little moments that make one dance. Okay, so we get these little moments of insight. And we continue to train. Okay, the focus in those who follow Dogen's practice is that the emphasis on the practice, not on trying to get something, you know, not even trying to get enlightenment, okay, but do the practice, and the little moments, they come, but they're temporary. You know, we don't dine out on the little moments that we get, but continue the practice, okay. So as I said, I'll relate some of the other stories that Dogen talks about in another Dharma talks. But in all of them, you know, the point he's making is that, yes, make venerative offerings, but make them with wisdom. Yeah. Make the offering of your practice. Okay, you can think, as the scripture says, well, how do I offer Dharma? I'm not a Buddhist teacher, you know. Even for Buddhist teachers, a lot of our teaching is not done sitting in front of an audience like this offering Dharma. Okay, you know, we have one of these talks once a week, and, you know, sometimes the monks have a Dharma talk by our abbots. But most of the time, we're just going about daily life. We're preparing food in the kitchen, or splitting firewood, or raking away pine needles from the buildings for fire abatement, or, you know, helping someone, explaining something via email, or, you know, as we all know, in this digital age, there's all these things we have to do to keep our computers up to date. And most of the teaching that we do occurs in the context of daily life, because that's where the koan arises. That's where the spiritual problem arises, and the teacher can see that arising in the student and address it right on the spot. Okay? That doesn't mean that everything the teacher says is right on. It's like target practice. It's a skill you learn, and you have to shoot a number of arrows before you hit the bullseye. Okay? So try to be generous when you're offering teachings. Okay? See, could this be true? You know, could what I'm being pointed out to be helpful? Okay? Particularly, I know myself, as once you get a disciple, you really discover there's not a rule book. There's not a book where you can look up, if the disciple says this, I answer this. Okay. Reverend Master G, I can remember, it's really emphatic once he said, don't you ever copy me. You know, don't parrot me. You have to respond to each situation spontaneously. No, every situation is unique. And this happens with each of you in lay life as well. You're continually offered opportunities to practice. They're continually offered opportunities where you can practice the Dharma, where you can make an offering of your practice. I know every time I go into town, if I go to Berryville, the natural food store, now there's always seems to be a line at the checkout counters there. It's successful business. But invariably, there'll be someone with, you know, a basket full of stuff, you know, and there'll be someone behind them that only has one or two items. And invariably, the person with the full basket will say, why don't you go ahead of me? You know, it happens every time. So you can see someone there practicing the Dharma, making an offering of their practice, being generous. And we're given opportunities like that all the time. Yeah. We're driving down the freeway and someone is trying to, you know, enter, you know. We can move over in the other lane and let them enter, so there's not this kind of, you know, anxiousness. Can I get in or not? You know. So we all have the opportunity to practice the Dharma in daily life, and we're continually giving those opportunities, and those are the offerings that lead to a true peace of heart and mind. Okay. Thank you for being here today. That's an offering, just being here. Okay. Don't underestimate the value of small offerings.